Got on the Move.
They were promised a certain salary, and when they get there, it's not the case. They get a lower pay, right? And they were promised a job here, and when they get there, they find out it's not the job. It's a lower job, right? So every single one have their own stories. And that actually gave me opportunities to relate the gospel, how God cares, right? How He loves.
The International Labour Organization estimates that in 2019, there were 169 million international migrant workers, and that's nearly 5% of the global workforce. In many countries, these foreign workers are an economical necessity, but are considered a nuisance, if not even a threat to the cultural and social identity of the receiving country. On the other hand, many celebrate diversity and multiculturalism. Whatever one's political opinion on this, what finds far too little attention is the amazing gospel opportunity that it constitutes. You are listening to God on the Move, a Lausanne Movement production, and this is a story about a beautiful opportunity of ministering to Nepali migrants in Malaysia. The voice you heard earlier is Kumar Ayal. He's the founder and executive director at the Himalayan Hope Foundation and member of the Lausanne LGA Editorial Advisory Board. And this is his story.
So I am Kumar Ayal. I'm originally from Nepal and currently based in Nepal. I have a wife, Catherine. She's from the Philippines. And we have three boys, Kevin is 7 and Kyle is 5 and Kurt is 21 months. I currently work as the founder and executive director of Himalayan Hope Foundation. It's a nonprofit company, a NGO that works primarily in the field of equipping leaders. We equip Christian leaders, and also we work with non-Christian leaders. Example would be government leaders, school teachers, leaders from marketplace, and so on. So that's one part of our ministry, is to equip leaders. And the other side of our ministry is to help develop communities. So we do a lot of community development work, and that's basically what we do as a ministry. As a cross-cultural missionary, I started my journey of living abroad as a migrant, right? In Malaysia, that was in 2005 and 6, and I was working with migrant workers. So that's the reason why I wanted to share on this topic today. My first-hand experience working with migrant workers in Malaysia, I was primarily working with migrant workers from Nepal, but I was in regular contact with migrant workers from 8 or 9 different countries in that particular location where I was based in Malaysia. And so that's my ministry in Malaysia as a cross-cultural worker. So I went to Malaysia in 2005. I was quite young. I was 22 years old. So that was right after 1 year of me finishing my bachelor's. I did bachelor's in theology in a Bible school in Nepal. So I went to Bible college right after my grade 12. So that's after 2 years of college, after high school, right? I went to college in 2 years, and then I went to seminary. In the seminary, God was already preparing me to be ready for His ministry, for His work. But I didn't know it would be in Nepal, it would be somewhere else. So climate was that, again, until now, the reality of parents wanting to send their kids abroad, right? Not only their kids, their husbands, right? You see, young men in general, you see that, of course, Nepal in reality economically is a poor country, and they would want better job opportunities, better education opportunities, better opportunities in general. So the whole climate in Nepal, the understanding of parents is that if we could send our children abroad to study better, then they can find a job, right? And then settle down. And if we can send our young men to foreign countries, then they can make money and support the family. So that's the whole climate. For me, personally, that's the overall climate of the country. So for me, I was going there as a missionary. I was not going to actually work and make money. I actually went to study in a Bible seminary. That's the two things I did, was that Malaysia being an M country, so I would not be allowed to go as a missionary. So I would go in there as a Bible school student in a professional visa, and I would do ministry as well. So that attracted me to Malaysia. Again, I think what helped me and my family is that the whole environment in Nepal in general, like the neighbors, the people in general would say, oh, your son is going abroad. That's a good thing, right? So for me, what attracted to me in person is that the idea of studying, furthering my study, and idea of serving. So is what attracted me. But again, people in my circle and my neighbors, they were happy for me because I was going abroad, right? We were happy for different reasons. But in general, my parents were also encouraging me to go because I would be exposed to different ideas, different cultures, right? But what prepared me to go to Malaysia at the age of 22 is basically the molding during Bible school days. So we had solid teaching, evangelical teaching. A lot of my teachers were actually graduates of the school I taught in the Philippines. So I had a lot of teachers. I think 70-80% of our teachers in the seminary in Nepal were graduates of the school where I taught later on in the Philippines. It was amazing. Yeah. So that's how I landed in Malaysia as a missionary. And after that, 2006, I came back to Nepal for about 2 years. And then I went to the Philippines and stayed there for about 12 years. And that's the reason why I said currently in Nepal, because we just moved back here about 2.5 years ago. So I lived there for about 12 years. I initially went to study. After finishing my studies, school asked me to join the faculty. So I started teaching, and my wife and I were both teaching in the seminary. And we came back as we felt that God was calling us back to Nepal about 2.5 years ago.
In Nepal, less than 5% of the population are Christian. And as we have learned from Indra in episode 5, it was only with the dawn of democracy in the early 2000s that Christianity had any measurable number. Bearing this in mind, I wondered how Kumar became a Christian.
We became Christians 31 years ago when I was 10 years old. So I'm 41 now. The journey of becoming a Christian back then, but 31 years ago, is that Nepal was still underground in terms of Christianity. So we would not be allowed to share our faith publicly and do mass evangelism events whatsoever. We were practicing our faith, but we would be doing that underground. There were a lot of government investigation, supervision going around, and there are so many restrictions when it came to Christians meeting, gathering, church activities, so on and so forth. So in that environment, how I came to know Christ is through my father, my parents. So brief testimony of my father. This is 31 years ago exactly. My father was a devout Hindu. Nepal is a Hindu country. Up until now, 2024, 84% of the population are considered Hindus. So my father, being a very devout Hindu, and Nepal back then had a caste system. So in India and in Nepal, we have caste system. We don't have it legally, but practically, you still have the practice in the villages. So in the caste system, we come from the higher caste. So coming from the higher caste and being a Brahmin caste and being a devout Hindu, for my dad to become a Christian 31 years ago was actually a miracle, I would say. On one hand, he had this issue going on in his mind. It's because he was into business. So most of the Brahmins are into studying the scripture, becoming priest, and doing a lot of government work and so on and so forth. But my father, being a Brahmin, got into business. Because of that, he had his friends and he was into alcohol, which is actually no-no in Hinduism. You can't be from a Brahmin and you can't drink. But my father was into drinking. That caused a lot of confusion and conflict at home, in the extended family, and so on. So my father was living with this idea that I'm a Brahmin, but I have business and I do drink, creates trouble in the family. So he was looking for peace in his inner heart and soul. So one day, 31 years ago, he went to visit a person related to his business. So back then they didn't have phone. So he had to go to his house to meet this guy. And my father went to meet this guy. And so happened the guy was not home. He was in the town center. And then his family invited my father in. So my father went to that house. And that's when he realized that house was different compared to other houses. Different in the sense that house didn't have any idols, any images, altars, so on and so forth. So in any Hindu household you enter, you would find altars, images of gods that you worship, and so many different statues in there. So that house was, for my dad, he said, empty. There was nothing inside. So that created a lot of questions in his mind, curiosity. So he started asking why you guys don't have any gods, altars, images in your house, and so on. So the family initially thought this guy came from the government to check on us. So they were hesitant to share all the details. But later on, after some conversation, they realized that my father was genuinely seeking, asking, wanting to know. So they shared that we are Christians and we believe in only one God. In Hinduism, the people worship 330 million gods. There's no count to it, right? So they said, we believe in only one God, and that God doesn't live on the walls. That God lives in our heart. That's why whatever happens, we pray and that God takes care of everything. So we have peace in our heart, in our family. And that thing, that word peace struck my father. So this is what I'm looking for. And he asked then a lot of more questions. How do I get this kind of peace that you have? I was actually going with my father back when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. I still remember going to temple, offering sacrifices, and then doing all of that. My father was tired. I want that peace. So the family shared about Jesus. And that was the first time my father heard about Jesus Christ. First time he heard about Bible. He heard about the whole idea of Christianity for the first time. What he was looking for is peace. And that family said, we have peace because of this one God that we worship. So my father had conversation. The person he was supposed to meet came. The whole family shared the gospel with him. And he spent about 1.5 hour of time in that house. And then he accepted Jesus right then and there. So that was a miracle. So for him, he was decided that this is what I'm looking for. And I think I found it. So I want to believe in this God. What should I do? The family said, if you're serious, we'll pray a prayer. You repeat after us. And that God, Jesus, comes into your heart. And you become a Christian today. And that's what my father did. And that was a complete U-turn for his life. He stopped drinking. He stopped all his habits. And he started going to church right after the day. I think it was Wednesday or Thursday. And in Nepal, worship happens on a Saturday. So it's not on Sunday. It's on a Saturday we worship. So that next Saturday, he went to church. And that's when our journey began as believers. He came home. He shared with us what he found. And we were in confusion for about 2 weeks. And then my mom was really confused what's happening with him. She thought he went crazy or what. So, but he was actually very serious about his faith. He said, I'm not going back. This is what I found. This is what I needed. I'm not turning back. So after, I think, a few days, he found another believer back then in the neighborhood. Back then, people didn't actually share. If they are believers, they would just keep it to themselves for their own safety. So he was looking. Now, intensively, he was looking for other believers. And he found one person nearby who actually became our disciples. And their family discipled our family. And then we started going to church. I started going to Sunday school, learning about Jesus. And that's the beginning of my whole Christian journey.
For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. May we never forget the impact our way of living has on others. Our words, actions, attitudes, habits, all about us tells a story about what we believe at the very core of our being. Having learned about Kumar's background, it's now time to carry on with the story about his time in Malaysia. What was it like? What were the challenges? And what did he do about it?
For me too, it was my first cross-cultural ministry experience. So for the first few months, actually, I was in a state of shock, as usual, right? When you move into a new place, new country, new culture, I was in a state of shock, but I was able to observe that, take it in and transition myself. A good thing in the school, we had different departments. They had English department, Chinese department, other department, and then a lot of friends from different countries as well. So that helped. And then with the ministry, I was able to transition quite quickly because in the ministry that I was serving, there was an existing Nepali pastor there who helped me. And then together we were able to start the ministry there. So in a sense, when I went in, it was a new experience for me to be in a new culture, new people group, new language, a new set of ministry. But again, what helped me is that determination and motivation I had in my mind is that to really learn. Not just I'm there to serve, but I'm there to learn as well. So I was with a learning attitude and that helped me to cope with the initial shock and the challenges along the way. I was always in a learning posture that I am here to learn so I can apply this in the future. That helped me a lot. But when it comes to ministry, you hear needs every single day. So my ministry, how it looked like is that I would be staying in the Bible school dormitory and I would take classes in the afternoon and my late afternoon and then late night would be ministry because that's when people are free, right? Because they would work the whole day as well. So they would be in their companies, their workplaces, and they would be free after their work hours, like around 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. And that's when I go and I meet people in their companies, in their hostels, or their dormitories, in their workplaces. And my first impression now looking back and thinking about in 2005, 2006 in Malaysia is that people, especially the people group I was intentionally serving was Nepali people group from Nepal. Everyone had problems. Every single one I've talked to have problems, have challenges, issues like being cheated by the agent who sent them to Malaysia from here, right? Issues of being cheated by the employer there. They were promised a certain salary, and when they get there, it's not the case. They get a lower pay, right? And they were promised a job here, and when they get there, they find out it's not the job. It's a lower job, right? So every single one have their own stories. And that actually gave me opportunities to relate the gospel, how God cares, right? How he loves. jobs. And that's how I was able to minister and serve, listen to the stories and talk to people and help them. And ministry was really amazing. The word I would use is amazing because we had about 200 people coming in that weekly worship in Malaysia, in a foreign country, right? Just the Nepali group. This is just the Nepali group. And that particular ministry network was running 8 different other ministries from 8 different other countries, migrant ministry. So in Nepali ministry alone, we had 200 people coming every Sunday. Our worship service would happen in the evening from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock. So Sunday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., we have more than 200 people. And then every night, we go visit people and do Bible study in small groups. The ministry is just amazing. And another amazing thing is that every Sunday, we had newcomers. We would call it fellowship, worship in a fellowship. We had newcomers coming in because the word of mouth, when someone comes in for the first time, he goes in and tells his workmates and his dorm mates that, oh, there's this Nepali gathering there. It's nice. It's fun. And they invite one after the other. And just amazing. What I would do, and that's what I did in several cases, is that I would direct them, guide them to God's promises, right? Promises in the Bible. And then I would relate to their situation. And because I mentioned earlier, they were promised a certain job, certain salary, and then they were cheated. They were given a different job, different salary. And what I would relate to bringing them back to God's word is that when God promised something to his people, he would fulfill his promises. He will keep his promises. He would not lie. He will not cheat. What he says he will do, that's what he will do. And we have examples from the Old Testament to the New Testament, the whole Bible. What God has promised, right? God fulfills. And that brings tears to people as they hear that. Again, we are talking about Hindus from Nepal who are in a foreign land, in a Muslim country in Malaysia. And they are hearing about this new God. For them, it's a new concept, right? Christianity, Jesus Christ, it's very new. And these people we're talking about are migrant workers. Most, I would say majority, almost all of them are from villages. These people are not from high classes. These are not who are rich, right? These are poor people from the villages who go as unskilled migrant workers in Malaysia. And for them, when you talk about the God who cares, God who loves, God who is compassionate, who keeps his promises, and they get teary-eyed. So that's how I would connect and I would relate to them with God's promises and trying to help them understand that you definitely have been cheated by your agent, by your employer, but God is not that who does this kind of cheating and I'm not giving what he promised. In the Bible, you give examples of what God promised, he fulfilled. And that's what he does in your life too, in my life too.
St. Paul writes to the Corinthians, "For no matter how many promises God has made, they are yes in Christ. And so through him the Amen is spoken by us to the glory of God. Now it is God who makes both us and you stand firm in Christ, and anointed us, set his seal of ownership on us, and put his Spirit in our hearts as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. As much reason it is to celebrate with and for the people who found Christ in this way. Their journey is far from over. As migrant workers, they will always return back to their home country, in this case, to predominantly Hindu Nepal, back to their families that haven't had the same experience."
Those Nepalese migrant workers who became Christians, believers in Malaysia, coming back is a whole new experience for them because they are coming back as Christians, right? They went to Malaysia as Hindus as they were. And in Hindu society, Hinduism is not actually considered as a religion. For them, it's a way of life, right? It's their part of life. And we've been Hindus for generations and there's no such thing as converting, yeah, changing religion. So now they come with a new identity because in their mind, in their heart, they know they are different than their family, their neighbors, and so on. So when they come back, it's really challenging for them to transition because in every household, in every family, they have rituals depending on what kind of God they worship. So depending on different clans, different castes, they have particular gods they worship. They focus on their worship, right? So every clan, every family has certain God. They worship many gods, but certain God they prioritize and worship. So everything happens, they worship. A few examples, let's say, if you intend to travel somewhere far, meaning you go to Malaysia, travel far, you worship, you do a ritual for protection. When you come back, there's a welcoming ceremony as well. So that's where it all begins, right? And then you pray for your protection, safety, you pray with incense and burning incense and putting tikka on your forehead, right? So on and so forth. Everything happens with a ritual in Hinduism. So when they get back, the first thing they will have to engage is in one of those rituals. And they know that they cannot actually engage in that because they know in deep inside, you have a new identity now. Even Jesus, you're a Christian now. So that's the struggle. That's where it all begins. A lot of times, back in 2005 and 6, it was even difficult. I would say more difficult compared to now, because now, 25, 30 years later, people are more exposed. Even in textbooks in high schools, they have about different religions, including Christianity. So people are exposed, but back then, not. A lot of times, what we would do before we send them, those new converts, is that we would help connect with a local church pastors or leaders here or near their surrounding, their village, or in the capital at least. And then from here, they would stay here for a few days and they would find a good connection, a Christian connection, either here in the city or in the village, if there's a church or if there are believers, then that's how we would link them up so that their journey would be smooth, at least compared to them not knowing anyone here. So that's what we would do. And currently, actually, with that initiative that started in 2005, we have now several ministries dedicated to the transition of new converts. And not only in Malaysia, in different Gulf countries, different other countries where Nepali migrants go to work. So when they come back as new Christians, there are several dedicated ministries to help transition these people, right? So that's how it all started back in 2005 when we were thinking about this. And that's how we would do. We would personally find someone we knew in the city or in the villages, and then we would connect them over the phone and then over Messenger, and then that's not Facebook Messenger back then, it's a Yahoo Messenger, right? And then we make the connection and they talk and then they meet with each other, and then that person here will help them transition. Several of those people actually have been literally kicked out of their families. Those people who came back, right, and went to the village and who told their family and their neighbors that they have become believers, Christians, they have literally been kicked out of their family. So several had to come back to the city or go back to a different country. And so there have been several cases where people have been kicked out. Back then, Christianity in general in Nepal was underground. So not only people coming from abroad, but even Christians who converted within Nepal were kicked out from their family. So that was a common case in the villages. And so we have several people from our fellowship in Malaysia who went to the village and were kicked out. So far, we've talked about Nepali migrants going to Malaysia, right? And how we, as Nepalis serving in Malaysia, were serving among the Nepali people, right? But again, the whole story is not complete if we don't include the churches in Malaysia who actually played a major role in bringing all these different migrant groups together, right? So they were the ones actually who helped provide that platform, that whole environment for us to meet, for us to minister to our own people in Malaysia. So I would like to share just about one particular. There are actually now more than 50 different networks in Malaysia, local church networks within Malaysia that are ministering to migrant workers. And the reason behind is that Malaysia is one of the countries, I would say, at least in Asia, who receives a lot of migrant workers. And now, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, Malaysia was just starting when it comes to their factories, right? So they needed a lot of labor force. So this is 2005. Malaysia had 30% of the population, migrant workers in the country. So only Nepali group, we had 500,000 Nepalis in Malaysia in 2005. 500,000 just from Nepal, and almost equal number from India, from Vietnam, a smaller number from Myanmar, from Bangladesh, so on and so forth. So all these different countries. So the local Malaysian churches saw that God was actually opening the door for Malaysia as a Muslim country to have all these different people groups coming into their country, in their doorsteps, right? So God was bringing the mission field to them. Instead of them going to this all these different 8, 9 countries, God was already bringing these people, Hindus, Buddhists, right? Muslims, all kinds of different people from countries to their own doorsteps. So they saw this migrant groups as opportunity to minister, to serve, right? So they saw migrant groups as a mission field. So instead of them traveling to other countries, they saw that God has already brought countries to them, and they opened their churches, they opened their homes, and they opened themselves in terms of serving and ministering, reaching out to these migrants. So in the place I was based, called Klang, which is about 45 minutes drive from KL, capital of Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur. So in Klang Valley, there were at least 14, 15 churches that came together for this particular migrant ministry. So with the same passion, with the same mission, is basically to reach out to the migrant workers in our city, right? So churches in Klang, 14 or 15 churches came together and they formed this ministry called Migrant Ministry Klang. They formed this ministry, all these different churches, and they would pull resources together and they would open their church buildings so the migrant groups could meet so they can worship in their own languages, right? So they would open their churches and they would even provide some snacks and they would be open to ministering to them if the migrant workers could speak English, and they would be open to listening to them. And a lot of these Malaysian friends would actually drive Nepali missionaries like myself and others, right? Initially, when I first went in, so I had to basically get my license and learn driving and so many other things in Malaysia. So in the initial phases, they would actually drive us, people like me, other missionaries from different countries, to go to their workplaces. This is at night. Again, our ministry begins in the evening, right? After their work hours. So we would go to their factories, their workplaces, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. We come back home midnight. But these people were willing to serve. So what I'm trying to communicate is that if we are on the receiving party, whether we're a church or a community or a country, where we have migrant workers coming in, maybe it's time now to see migrant workers as God-sent mission field to us, to our doorsteps, and look for opportunities, look for avenues, how we can minister to them. There's a lot of ways actually we can serve. And particular examples I would like to give definitely is from Malaysia, right? How the Malaysian churches serve. I mentioned a few of those earlier. And the other way is how they actually served different people groups, including the Nepali people group, is that they would actually help the Nepali churches here to select missionaries like myself and then go. So they would even support people like myself to serve in Malaysia so that they have a part in bringing in a worker in their country. And they would join hands together with me, people like me as a Nepali missionary, serving them in Nepalese, right? And they would come together to be able to reach out to our people, but in their country. And the extent some of the Malaysian friends have gone actually is to really bring these people to their homes as well. And that actually helped solidify our message, because we are talking about God's care, God's love, right? God is compassionate. And we give them examples, right? Look at this Malaysian friends. These are not our brothers or sisters. These are foreigners, but we are in their country and these people are bringing you to their homes. They're caring for you, right? They're taking care of you. And a lot of times these people would even bring them to the hospital when they get sick, right? So we can give tangible examples up to these Nepali migrant workers. Look at this Malaysian friends. They are taking care of you because that's how God loves. They are just expressing God's love to you. And that's a very solid message to help people understand. And I would really appreciate Malaysian churches. But again, the message goes to any other church or the receiving party. If we are in that role, there's a lot that we can do to be able to reach out and help the migrant workers, migrant groups, right? Again, one example I gave is to have different churches come together, form a network or what, to be able to intentionally reach out to migrant groups in your own country or context. That could be one. It all begins by understanding the role that God has given us, right? If we see migrant groups as people, God's people, and if we see them as God sent, right? They're not just there to work for you, but they are sent by God to serve you, so you can also serve them back as God serves. And if we see them, then we can treat them with respect, with dignity, and we can definitely share the love of God with them. So I think that actually breaks a lot of boundaries if we start with that, how we view or how we look at the migrant workers.
Before we continue with the story, I want to let you know that we want to share gospel stories from the Global Church with the Global Church. So if you have a story to share or know someone who might have, please contact us at podcast@lausanne.org. That is podcast@lausanne.org. We would also appreciate your feedback on God on the Move, as this will help us improve our podcast to the audience. You can find the link in the podcast description.
And another thing in particular in Malaysia, what worked is that the local churches and even some individual believers would not only open their house to invite the migrant workers, they would actually open what they had this called mission house. Mission houses are houses. And let's say, example, someone has an empty house, right? And not being used, not being rented. And that person gives that house for the use of service for the ministry. Let's example, there was someone who gave his empty house to us, Nepali ministry. So we would use it to do Bible studies, small groups, language training, so on and so forth. And then in addition to that, during the weekends, people would come there and they have sleepovers. And there was enough space for people to sleep and they would just sleep with their friends. And they have fellowship, they have sharing in a foreign country. You work day in and day out for 6 days and then you come in and talk in your language and then share about life and eat together and you stay there. So a mission house was another great avenue where people would open up, people would cry, people would share, and it gave us extended time to sit with them, to talk to them, to eat with them, to minister to them. So that's another way how the Malaysian church help in terms of opening their mission houses or empty houses, turning the houses to become a mission house, right? Or dropping centers or language centers, right? So on and so forth. Another thing I would like to share in terms of the receiving party, Malaysian churches as a receiving party, how they help in the ministry to the migrants is that they did not see that ministry to the migrants should be just focused on particular denomination or church network or so on. The 14 or 15 churches we had in the network were all different denominations. So they basically cross the boundary of their own denomination, church network, to serve with one purpose is to serve the migrants. I think that will also be something encouraging for people in different countries and communities. So churches can come together, and it also brings churches together in unity with this purpose of serving and reaching out to the migrants. How my ministry to the migrants related to serving in the Philippines is that the school where I and my wife taught in the Philippines had students from more than 20 countries. So we would definitely meet students from all different Asian countries, mostly Asian countries, others too. So that's one example of serving the multicultural group of people in terms of equipping pastors and leaders. But aside from that, there was one particular ministry that we were doing, even in the Philippines, because our heart is always reaching out to the people, right? Migrants, people in a different country than their own. So we were reaching out to Nepalese in the Philippines as well. Back then, we had Nepali medical students. And now this is a different, whole different people group, right? In Malaysia, it's a migrant working class, right? Unskilled workers. Now in the Philippines, these are medical doctors, meaning they are studying medicine, right? Doing their medicine studies to become medical doctors. And that's a very strategic group of people we're reaching out to. So I would teach in a Bible seminary, and then during the weekends, we would go and visit these Nepali students in their universities. And then it gave us a good platform because I was a professor teaching in a seminary. And our school actually doesn't sound like a seminary. The name of our school is International Graduate School of Leadership. So we focused on training leaders. And when we go and present themselves to them, I'm a professor at International Graduate School of Leadership. And I'm from Nepal as well. And they actually are so welcoming. And we begin talking. We begin inviting each other, sharing the gospel. So that's one group of people that are very strategic, and several people who have come back, and they have a good, I would say, avenue. When they come back here, they are medical doctors and they have good influence, impact in Nepal. And so that's been a good example of serving Nepalese in a different country, in a different context. And this time, medical students in the Philippines. So that was a brief example of what we did in terms of reaching out to Nepali young people, medical students in the Philippines. But primarily my job was there to teach. So I taught full-time for about 9 years. After finishing my studies, I taught 9 years there. And then God gave us a sense that he's calling us back to Nepal, back to the real mission field. Again, Bible seminary is a real mission field, but we could serve here where the need is in terms of evangelism, discipleship, church planting, so on and so forth.
Regular listeners of God on the Move can perhaps anticipate my next question. Whenever someone is talking about a calling from God, I'm curious. What does that actually mean? What does it look like? How does it work? What is your understanding of a calling? So obviously, I had to ask Kumar as well. And here is his response.
There are a few things, actually. One is that my wife and I prayed about it for more than a year. So we started praying about it in 2019, and we moved back in 2021. So more than a year, we were seeking God in terms of whether God wants us to stay in the Philippines or teaching at a Bible school where we're teaching, or he wants us to go to Nepal, right? And the whole idea of coming to Nepal started because my wife and I both had this urging desire to start a pioneering ministry. Again, we're doing a wonderful ministry in the school we're teaching. We're mentoring students. As I mentioned earlier, we had students from 20 different countries, and we had a great privilege of equipping all these Asian leaders from different countries. Ministry was amazing. I was also working as a missions pastor at a local church, and we were serving, equipping God's people. But what called us back is that our desire deep inside, that maybe we thought we have done our part. I thought about 9 years. My wife thought about being full-time and part-time about 11, 12 years. So we thought maybe this season of equipping leaders in the Philippines, which is considered the only Christian nation in Asia, though it's Roman Catholic, right? But how people perceive is that Philippines is a Christian country. And the whole idea is that we want to pioneer a ministry. And where? Again, in Nepal, because where the need is, again, 84% are still Hindus now. And there's a lot of villages in Nepal that are literally unreached, right? So we actually currently have, in the statistics, if you look at Joshua Project and other statistics, we have 90%+ of the population in Nepal that are unreached, meaning there's a huge, huge opportunity in Nepal and to begin a pioneering ministry of evangelism, discipleship, church planting. And that's actually why we felt that God was leading us here. Not that we are not doing God's ministry in the Philippines, but we thought that equipping pastors and leaders, we've done enough for that season of our time. We did 9-10 years. Now God is calling us to another season in life where we want to pioneer. We want to be on the field and do ministries like church planting, evangelism, discipleship, and being in the villages, in the fields. And that's why we came back. That's why God brought us back. As God called us, so we have started this ministry, a nonprofit. It's definitely named is Malino Foundation. So what we do is primarily two things. We do leadership development, because that has been our experience, our background, training leaders, teaching in a seminary for about 10 years. And then we do community development work. And when we say community development work, we focus on holistic community development work. When we say holistic, we're talking about economic development, we're talking about psychological development, we're talking about spiritual development, and we're talking about social development. So we focus on these four areas of development in an individual, in a family, in a community, in a society, and hopefully in a country. So that's how we do community development work. We go to different villages in Nepal. We do school projects in, of course, poor villages where schools have challenges bringing in students because of lack of school supplies, because of lack of school uniforms, school bags and shoes and so forth. So we provide these basic necessities so kids could go to school. We also provide some scholarship to orphans and kids that have no parents or have a hard time just getting to school. And so that's a part of our community development work. We also do eye camps, medical camps, whatever is needed in the community. So we don't just provide what we think they would need. We go do a survey and figure out the need in the community. And we go in and try to help the community to basically express God's love to the community. Because the majority of the communities that we serve are basically not Christians, Hindus. And we may find some Christian connections. And we go in and share God's love with them. And it opens the door for the gospel in the near future, not now, right? So we have heard very positive feedback in the places we've done community projects, and these are strong Hindu leaders, government leaders, community leaders, and they have very high praise for what we have done, what God has done through Himalayan Hope Foundation. So our efforts have been focused on two areas: developing leaders, developing communities. Developing leaders, so let me explain briefly what we do is we do a few things in developing leaders. We do Bible study training for pastors and leaders. For Christians, we do Bible study training, right? For non-Christian leaders, we do leadership training because we have the experience teaching in a leadership school and we can teach all the leadership courses. So we do leadership training for marketplace and education, all these different leaders. And so that's how we've been equipping leaders, because in Nepal, what we need currently, the church needs is leaders, good leaders. What our government needs is good leaders. Nepal has one of the worst corruption in the world. The corruption index is very high. So we're trying to help produce good leaders in Nepal. So we do a lot of equipping of leaders, both Christians and marketplace leaders, right? So that's one. And in equipping Christian leaders, not only we do Bible study training for lay pastors and leaders, we also run a PhD program. So I am running a satellite of a PhD program from a university in the Philippines. So we have a group cohort here, and then we've been running it for more than 1.5 years now. So we're running a PhD cohort to really equip high quality leaders. So that cohort is for Christian leaders. And so that's another thing we do in terms of equipping leaders here. So those are primary two areas of work. And now, starting this month, in January 3rd, we launched a new ministry initiative, which is basically something that God has called us back from the Philippines to do, is to plant churches. So we have launched 17 church planters in 8 different districts of Nepal. We have started church planting ministry with the hope, with the goal to plant, hopefully by God's grace, 50 churches in the next 2 years. We have 17 church planters in the first batch, so they are launched, and then we're recruiting more to be able to send in different other districts. So our goal is really to pray and do all that we could do to expand God's kingdom in Nepal through this church planting ministry initiative. And aside from sending them to the field, what we have also started is the program called Diploma Certificate for these church planters. So we are running a 3-year diploma program in collaboration with the Nepali Bible College here. Actually, it's the Bible College where I studied back in 2002 or 2003, right? So that Bible College, and we collaborated to provide diploma certificate for our church planters. So they not only go and plant churches, they are being equipped as well. So in 2 years, they'll finish their coursework and get a diploma certificate. So those are new initiatives in terms of our ministry. But our whole idea of the Malin Hope Foundation is to bring hope of Jesus to the villages, to the mountains, the Himalayas of Nepal, and to expand God's kingdom in Nepal through evangelism, discipleship, church planting, and through training of leaders.
As always, there is so much more to say. We've even skipped a whole era in the Philippines. I've started asking guests on the podcast what they would say to the global church if they had the chance. Here's Kumar's word to the church, followed by prayer requests.
So in the topic we're talking about, when it comes to the whole idea of migration, right? Again, I think it's not a recent phenomenon, as we all know. The history of humanity is a history of migration, right? People have been in the move since the Exodus from the Garden of Eden, Genesis chapter 3. Men and women have been on the move, right? So we've been on the move, whether within our country or outside the boundaries of our country. And as we all know, also, just in the closing note, currently there are about 271.6 million people in the world living in a country other than their own country of birth, meaning people are on the move. And right now, with the geopolitical situation that we are in, it's a lot easier for people to move around. And that also opens the door for people like migrants to go to another country and work, right? So people are definitely on the move. And we see this not only as a flow of people in and out the country, but we see this as God's way of bringing people in and bringing people out of the country. So these people who go in or who go out to a particular country, will have the privilege, opportunity to hear the gospel. So we are seeing God is bringing people to Europe, right? God is bringing people to the North America and different other countries where Christianity is a majority faith. And God is opening doors. Now, the receiving party, I mentioned earlier, the roles, what kind of role can we could play as a receiving party in reaching out and serving these migrants who are in our doorsteps? I think we should think about finding ways to reach out to them, seeing them as God-sent people, ministry opportunity that we can go and serve and bring the light of Jesus to them. And I would also like to make a brief comment on if you're a sending country like Nepal and other migrant-sending country, also we need to be thinking about how can we send people, right? So just a very brief note, I'm talking more on the churches maybe who would be sending their people to different countries to work, and then maybe communities and hopefully in a bigger scale countries as well, that they send people to other countries. I think some of the things that we can think about when it comes to sending people is to help them with awareness, right? Awareness in terms of which country they are going to. Do they know, the migrants know about the religion of the country, the social climate of the country, the cultural aspect, the economic, so on and so on. Just the awareness is very helpful for them to transition, for them to just have a smooth transition and get into the workforce and so on and so forth. Another one is actually for believers. If the local churches can actually provide them with basic evangelism, discipleship training as they are preparing to go, right? So that we are preparing our migrant workers as missionaries. So if we do that, they will become missionaries in their workplaces, in their companies, right? So we'll be sending thousands of missionaries from Nepal to other countries, right? From India, from Myanmar, Bangladesh to other countries. So we see that not only missionaries come from the West, right? The Western countries, but we can send missionaries within other countries, within Asia and other countries. If we prepare these people, migrant workers, with basic evangelism and discipleship, that's all the training they would need. And then they can be the evangelists in their own companies, among their circle of friends. And that's one way we can prepare. If we know someone from our church going as a migrant worker, why can't we just train them briefly in terms of how to share their faith and how to disciple a person? And that'd be a great help. That way we can raise up thousands of, or I would say worldwide, millions of missionaries to be able to send in different countries, right? And also help connect with migrant workers or others if we know local churches. That'll be a great connection for them to go a new country and start easy transition and be able to connect. And support is very important, right? Support group when you're in a foreign country, to find someone you know would be very encouraging, right? And for those countries like Nepal that sends a lot of migrants, one thing to really consider is to teach people about proper financial management. I have actually seen and heard stories after stories of how migrant workers have earned money, but they have not been able to handle it well. And since they don't have financial literacy, they don't know how to manage money. So they have wasted their money literally in gambling, in prostitution, so on and so forth. Sad stories. So So again, financial literacy is something also sending party can do to prepare their migrant workers so they are ready, and when they go, their hard-earned money will be safe and will help their family, their country in general as well. And then keep an open line of communication with their families and churches so the person will be encouraged and have a good flow of communication back and forth. So those are some encouragements on the sending party, right? Please do pray for Himalayan Hope Foundation that we will be true to our mission and vision, the reason why God has brought us from the Philippines and called us to do what he has called us to do. Again, as I said earlier, we are all after equipping up Nepali leaders, both Christians and non-Christians, so we have better churches and we have better country, better government. So we are all after equipping Nepali leaders and developing communities in a holistic manner. So we're not just after spiritual development of people. We're after economic, social, psychological, and spiritual development of an individual, of a family, of a society, of a community, and hopefully of a country. Please pray that God would continue to guide us and lead us in fulfilling his mission through the ministry of Himalayan Hope Foundation. Revolving around poverty and development, because Nepal being a poor country, a lot of community work that we do, I mentioned earlier, revolves around working with poor communities, right? My actually study, the field of study has been poverty and development. So that actually helps a lot in terms of the framework that we use here, the holistic development framework and serving. I have also written a book on poverty and development in the Philippine context. So that would give you an idea of how we are reaching out to the poor in Nepal. That's the framework, right? Poverty and development. Maybe I'll send you a link and then you can find that. And then we're trying to draw some principles from that and apply it in Nepal and help Nepali families, Nepali communities develop in a holistic manner. And hopefully through this, we'll be able to contribute for the whole development of the country as well.
You've listened to God on the Move, Lausanne Movement podcast, where we want to listen to mission stories from the global church. Through listening to what God is doing around the world, we hope to encourage and challenge the global church to faithful obedience to the Great Commission. So let's accelerate global mission together toward a vision for the gospel for every person, disciple-making churches for every people and place, Christ-like leaders in every church and sector, and kingdom impact in every sphere of society. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, be sure to subscribe and follow us for more.